for listening to KHOL. This is Jackson Unpacked, our weekly show featuring reporting and interviews on local news, music, and culture. I'm News Director Kyle Mackey. Just a quick reminder before we get started that if you're not already listening to Jackson Unpacked as a podcast, please subscribe today and help support Jackson's only nonprofit newsroom. Jackson Unpacked is now available on Apple or Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Coming up on today's show, KHOL Music Director Jack Catlin talks with the local band Strumbucket about the making of their upcoming debut album.
I've heard this from so many musicians. Never take yourself too seriously, but take what you do seriously.
Plus, we hear from a Colorado woman who was recently evacuated from Myanmar, or Burma, after a military coup threw the country into chaos and violence on February 1st.
I thought getting away, I'd be relieved, but I'm not. I'm more wrought up and like angrier.
But first, Mental Health JH announced Tuesday that its services will come to an end this summer. The pilot program was created during the pandemic to offer 6 free mental health visits to all Teton County residents. The phase out of services means that locals might now have a harder time finding and paying for counseling sessions due to budget cuts at the state level. KHOL's Will Walkie reports on how those cuts could end up costing Wyoming down the line.
Fran Van Houten started seeking a therapist when she was 18. She says she first went in college when she felt like things just weren't quite going right for her. Now, more than 40 years later, it's still part of her healthcare routine.
So in the same way that I have my regular doctor and my dentist and my eye doctor, I have a counselor.
Van Houten has struggled with anxiety and depression for years, including during the 2 decades she lived in Jackson Hole. She says having a therapist has kept her grounded through transition periods or stressful moments during her career as a life coach and professional facilitator.
One of the things I notice in me when I think like I need a little help is my sleep is disrupted and that I'm just like, I just am like a little disengaged. Like I would say like I'm watching the world go by rather than like participating.
Van Houten is one of millions of people in the United States who seek what mental health experts call primary preventative care. Elizabeth Shirotis has had a private counseling practice in Jackson for the past 17 years. She says primary prevention is important because it allows counselors to intervene before their patients harm themselves or others. Secondary and tertiary care comes into play when people are missing work or drinking more or even feeling suicidal.
It's the smallest population, but it's the population that costs the most to treat. Hospitalization, crisis services, productivity loss in businesses are due to that small population.
Shirotis says since the pandemic started, she's been seeing more and more people in those more serious secondary and tertiary situations.
We're seeing people with more acute symptoms like headaches, body aches, anger issues.
Shirotis participates in the Mental Health JH program, which she says broke down a lot of barriers for a broad group of people, from teachers to food service workers who can't typically afford counseling. Megan Murtaugh, a local real estate agent, is one of about 825 community members who sought help from the program over the past 10 months.
Therapy over the years teaches you how to help yourself. I still get like severely triggered by things. And instead of having to be like wait to call and talk to my therapist, I now have the tools of like, okay, if I can like sit down and do a meditation and like talk to myself like my therapist would talk to me, I can calm myself down.
As the child of an alcoholic, Murtaugh says she struggled with anxiety and depression for decades. She's also been in therapy on and off for about 17 years, but she says Mental Health JH made meeting a counselor easier.
And I feel like people who have started doing therapy on Zoom, they're like, oh, this is great. I can like talk from my couch and I feel like I'm talking to someone in my home and it's a little bit less scary.
A locally run option for teletherapy, though, won't be as easy to come by starting May 31st. That's when Mental Health JH will stop accepting applications from new patients and start the process of ending its services, partially due to declining funds. Deidre Ashley is executive director for the Jackson Hole Community Counseling Center and says her state funding has been systematically cut over the past 15 years.
Our agency has gone from being about 60 to 65% reliant on those state contracts for our overall budget to now we're at 30%.
Like Shirotis, Ashley says she's seen demand for counseling increase dramatically during the pandemic. But at the same time, Governor Mark Gordon recently recommended a 9% budget cut for the Wyoming Department of Health. For the counseling center, that'll cost about $75,000, or about the salary of one therapist.
The needs across the board are rising, you know, getting to the point where these funding sources are having to prioritize. And the concern is that providing resources in, you know, all in one bucket may leave some people out.
So who's being left out? For the most part, the counselors KHOL interviewed say it's people seeking early prevention care who can't afford it themselves. A bill signed during the recent state legislative session will limit state funding for mental health and substance abuse services to just a handful of priority groups, like those in the criminal justice system or with severe debilitations. So, Ashley may have to start turning some clients away if they aren't a part of that narrow, high-risk population. That puts pressure on the entire human services sector in Teton County, including private practitioners like Shirotis.
And I don't want to sound alarmist at all, but this is a really serious situation. It means we as private providers are getting referrals for clients who may need a higher level of care than we can provide.
Mental Health JH was partially supported by private donors, of which there are many in Teton County. Shirotis says she expects local philanthropy to continue financing similar programs, but she also worries that it's unsustainable to rely on that funding model.
We have amazing, amazingly generous people in this community, but we can't rely on donations for the mental health needs of an entire community. That funding from the government is very, very important.
For now, Shirotis says anyone interested in counseling should still visit mentalhealthjh.org to look at their options. People like Fran Van Houten will keep getting the help they need for the foreseeable but unknown future.
There have been a handful of times in my life when I scared myself and had never really thought about self-harm. But there was a thought, and I was like, I can't believe my head is going there. And because I already had counseling in my life, I was able to call immediately.
Wyoming has the second highest suicide rate in the nation. And both Ashley and Shirotis say reducing stigma and the costs of seeking counseling should be a major goal for the state if it wants to improve on this grim statistic. To them, that means investing in counseling services, not cutting it. Will Walkie, KHOL News.
Coming up next, KHOL music director Jack Catlin interviews two members of the band behind the music for Jackson Unpacked.
Local band Strumbucket's sound has been described as twang funk, featuring a mix of country, rock, bluegrass, jazz, and funk. The five-piece band has been working hard on their debut album, set for release later this year. Lead singer and banjo player Alex Blackwelder and drummer Peter Henderson join us now in the KHOL studio. So the roots of this band are deep, going back many years with three of you guys growing up together and attending the same high school on the East Coast. How do you think the South works its way into your music and maybe specifically that area of the South?
The South can kind of get grouped into representing one thing, or I think it's hard to just hear one particular genre when you're living there. You're hearing the country bluegrass, but you're getting a lot of that Southern rock. You're getting a lot of blues. There are definitely a lot of great jazz players there, not to mention you got jug bands, and it's all just little bits of flavor that we're able to draw from. Definitely as music lovers, we've absorbed all that, and we're trying to now incorporate that into a little bit of our playing.
So you describe yourself as twang funk. Can you describe what that means to you?
Twang funk.
twang funk.
Yeah, it sounds cool. Yeah, I don't know who came up with that. Maybe it was just as a group, we were trying to think of something that, you know, wasn't just rock or country. And I think the twang comes a lot from Alex and his electric banjo, which you don't see a lot.
I think if you were to come see us, you would probably say, like, this is rock and roll or this is Americana. You would try to fall under one of those major labels of genres. And so for us, it was a self-branding thing, too, to try to get the point across to people that you're going to hear this spectrum.
You clearly draw from a diverse range of genres, like you just said. Does that come from the eclectic tastes of individual members or just an overall musical curiosity throughout the group?
I know a lot of the more traditional bluegrass country tunes, Grove and Lavender. They have a big encyclopedia and know a lot of like samba and bossa nova tunes that they're able to bring. And then we kind of all fall in.
I would also say it keeps the live performances fresh too, because one moment you're listening to a up-tempo bluegrass tune and then we totally switch it to kind of Latin groove and then funk and then back to country ballad, something like that. So for us, it keeps it fresh, practicing and incorporating all those into our list of songs and our catalog.
So you're known for keeping it light and fun, but also have a few more serious songs in your arsenal. How important is it to have that balance when writing and performing?
I've heard this from so many musicians. Never take yourself too seriously, but take what you do seriously. You know, you can have a really lighthearted, funny, cheeky song, and it can be just as good as the improvisational piece that you're pulling off that's very mathematical and technical. As long as you're recognizing, don't take yourself too seriously, take what you do seriously and approach it in that manner, you can kind of find a happy place. That's just part of the journey we're taking you on too, because that's life. You know, life is slap happy and funny, and then sometimes it breaks down and it gets a little more serious.
So switching gears, Alex and Peter, you two have a long-running show here on KHOL called The Fondue that airs every Tuesday from 4 to 6 p.m. What is the overall direction of the show and how does it relate to the Strum Bucket project?
Yeah, honestly, when we started, I just kind of hit up Alex and was like, I think this would be super fun. We kind of put together an initial 30-song list of kind of what we would be playing, and it was very similar in a way to kind of how the band and our songs have grown over time and just the different genres that we hit on. But the Fondue is a melting pot of whatever we're kind of listening to at the moment. We obviously listen to a lot of music that influences us, and so I think that is reflected in kind of the songs we choose.
There is a similar progression of moving out of this sort of more mellow, maybe folky Americana, and slowly gradually building up to that 6 p.m. mark. It's almost getting into more of the electronic funk side of things towards the end of the show. That's similar in our sets with the band as well. As yeah, I think the show and the way we plan the sets are very similar in their diversity.
So what's next for Strum Bucket? I know you're working on your debut album. How is that coming along?
It's been a fun project over the winter when we were slow with gigs. We sat down for a couple weeks last November and tracked probably upwards of like 30 to 40 songs/ideas. So we're pretty excited about the, I would say, maybe dozen or so tunes that we're looking at for this debut album.
We're starting to actually take some of these newer ones and play them out live. And that's a great opportunity to test what's working, what's lacking, kind of working with this huge inventory we have right now and trying to group those, piece those, see what has room to grow.
Here's Strum Bucket's music right here on KHOL during our local music hour weekdays from 3 to 4 p.m. I'm Jack Catlin, and this is KHOL Jackson.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Jackson Unpacked on KHOL. I'm News Director Kyle Mackey, and this is our weekly show featuring reporting and interviews on local and regional news, music, and culture. Jackson Unpacked airs Wednesdays at 7:30 a.m. and Fridays and Sundays at 12:30 p.m. And you can also now listen and subscribe to the show as a podcast on your favorite podcast app. Our next two stories today come to KHOL through the Rocky Mountain Community Radio Collaborative. Last year, Colorado lawmakers pointed a finger at something they saw as a growing threat, speculative investments in water rights. Since then, a state work group has been examining the issue, and the process has brought up some thorny questions about the entire system the Western U.S. uses to divvy up scarce water supplies. Reporters Heather Sackett from Aspen Journalism and Luke Runyon from KUNC have more.
Melting snow and flowing irrigation ditches means spring has finally arrived at the base of Grand Mesa in western Colorado.
We're along the banks of the Alfalfa Ditch with the team behind Conscience Bay, a Colorado-based investment firm.
So they can turn water back into the main stem of the creek here, or they can let it run on down this way.
That's company president Eli Feldman. The water from this ditch is spread across an arid valley to grow hay and pasture for grazing cattle.
This is Hearts Basin Ranch. The company owns it, and a contractor runs it.
And they own the rights to much of the water in this ditch, too. Conscience Bay bought the ranch in 2017, and its intentions have been under scrutiny ever since.
From local officials and other ranchers.
Anytime you come into a place that you're not from, people are curious at best and skeptical and concerned at worst.
Feldman's company has been accused of speculation, of buying this ranch just for its senior water rights and hoarding them for profit, an accusation he says is false.
Because just like every other major water user in the state, the water here is being put to use and not simply accruing value.
We're growing grass and feeding it to cows and trying to improve the ground, improve the soil health, and make a business out of it.
But investments like these are being scrutinized by a state-sanctioned work group made up of some of the most prominent water thinkers in Colorado.
State lawmakers have made the issue a top priority. They want to prevent out-of-state interests, motivated by increasingly dry conditions, from buying up water rights. Colorado State Engineer Kevin Ryan co-leads the group.
I think it's a valid concern because they do see unusual parties, large parties that, again, aren't the typical parties purchasing those water rights. So that's their concern.
Like many Western states, Colorado considers the right to use water as private property that can be bought and sold and moved from farms to fast-growing cities.
The state already has laws to make sure it's put to use right away. That means discussions about reining in speculation come down to intent.
Do we want to protect against certain types of intent? And then how do we determine that?
So is someone purchasing water rights to grow hay?
Or are they hatching a nefarious plot to act as the middleman and sell the rights off to the big city nearby?
There aren't speculation police roaming the state and breaking up these investments, right?
That's Alex Funk with the Colorado Water Conservation Board. He's also a member of the work group.
Funk says they've struggled to come up with answers to even some basic questions.
Like, what is the definition of speculation?
It's one thing to point at something and say, oh, that's probably speculative. Another to actually put the legal definition on it.
Farmers and ranchers see both a threat and opportunity in the rise of the private water investor. On the one hand, they worry about their communities if all their neighbors sell.
But when it's their turn to receive a check for their water rights, they don't want regulators to restrict who can purchase those rights, even a private investor. Carlisle Currier is a rancher in Molina, Colorado, and the president of the Colorado Farm Bureau.
Because if the government can tell them they can't buy a farm and farm it, well, they can tell me that, too. I don't want them telling me that, so.
Back at Hearts Basin Ranch, investor Eli Feldman says he's not the enemy. His operation isn't the mom-and-pop homestead ranch of the Old West.
It's the investor-owned, employee-operated, risk-taking ranch of the New West.
Is speculation just another word for investment? But it's got a negative connotation to it because it's somebody that's not from here? Okay, well, do you not want to have investment in rural Colorado? Is that what we're after?
He sees all the anxiety about speculation as a reflection of something much deeper.
Water supply throughout the West is shrinking, and deciding how best to deal with the growing shortages still comes with more questions than answers. I'm Luke Runyon.
And I'm Heather Sackett.
our final story today, Kate Redmond of KBNF in Paonia, Colorado, interviews a Fort Collins woman named Tamara Doak, who was recently evacuated from Myanmar after the February 1st military coup. Doak was teaching at a school in the city of Yangon and speaks with Redmond about her firsthand experience of the protests, violence, and arrests that have followed the coup. As a warning, this story includes descriptions of violence that may be disturbing for some listeners.
When Burma held their elections on November 8th of last year, Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party won a resounding victory. The military stunned the world when in February, the day the new parliament was to take their seats, they declared the election fraudulent and launched a military coup. Since that time, people in the country continue to languish with an 8 p.m. curfew, loss of livelihood, and brutal repression. I spoke with Tamara Doak, a Colorado woman who was working in the city of Yangon, and seeing that the situation was deteriorating, decided it was time to get out.
What made you make the decision to leave?
Well, a couple of things. Most of my core group in my neighborhood were leaving or had already gone, and I was feeling more isolated because it really wasn't safe to go out much. And then one day there was a big explosion that shook my building, and I guess they blew up the Myanmar passport office, and that kind of threw me. And then I listened to the last town hall meeting that the American ambassador staged, and he said, basically get out as soon as you can by commercial airlines as soon as possible. And then someone was offering a charter flight for kind of a pet evacuation. So I left with, 17 dogs, a bunch of cats and 2 rabbits all in the cabin and a few humans. So I thought I'd get that flight to Bangkok and just go.
The ambassador was not arranging for flights. He was encouraging you to take commercial flights.
Right. They had done one relief flight at the end of March, like March 28th, and I got a seat on that. And then my board said, don't go. You need to stay and lead the school. And, you know, I didn't have to do what they said, but I decided to try to stay a bit longer. I was going to try to stay till June, but then things continued to get worse, and they're, you know, shooting people in the back and sniper shooting in the head and killing children and... You know, there's no money in the ATMs. It's, you know, they're closing the supermarket. It's just getting harder to live and manage.
And when the coup first happened, did you think it would go on this long?
The first couple of weeks were quite joyful. It was like a carnival atmosphere, everybody out in the streets. And I was going to the demonstrations and watching. They were very clever. There was like street performance and singing and dancing and just felt very, very positive. And I knew that wouldn't last. I knew that soon, you know, the military is letting them do their little protests and then they'll roll over. And that's what they expected. They didn't expect people to fight back as hard as they did. And so that made me really proud. When people were fighting back, I really didn't know what to expect. No one really did. Still, people don't know exactly what's going to happen.
During the election, did it seem that the balloting was going well and it was orderly and that there would be a transfer of power?
Yeah, it seemed fine, but it was February 2nd. I was waiting for that date to get, that's when they would seat parliament. I figured if we got to there, everything would be fine, but then course, they did the coup on February 1st. I was nervous, sure. Aung San Suu Kyi won by a landslide. Not everybody loves her. You know, not all the people doing CDM now want to restore the NDL. They want some sort of a more inclusive government. Really, it's an experimental government. To have military and elected kind of fusion government is very unique. And, you know, it seemed to be working for a while until this.
And do you know what is the status of the political prisoners now?
They've arrested so many people. People are just disappearing in the night all the time. You know, even in my building, they installed new doors. And if I'd come home, curfew's at 8, if I'd come home at 8, which now and then I did, I tried not to. The old man would have to undo all the chains he'd put, and they put another security door. And people were quite terrified. I don't know.
Even before the election, did you feel like there was fear of the military by Burmese people?
No. I think everybody was quite hopeful, especially the young people. You know, they had a taste of being out in the world again. And then the elections went through without a lot of bad things happening around it. I think people were feeling quite hopeful. I know that there was that worry until parliament got seated, but There is just a feeling of hopefulness and happiness, really.
And the press that I have seen, women are very much involved in the protests. Was that your experience?
Oh, very much. Even my teachers at my school would come in and make their signs and laminate them. And when they started shooting, they backed off a little bit. But women were very, very vocal and very active. And they'd have children out there in the beginning. And it was like a family. It'd be multi-generation. Probably the whole household would go, the grandparents, the parents, the children, everybody. And then also the gay lesbian community started coming out, and it was a sort of a venue for everybody to kind of project themselves out there, like, and ask for recognition.
Is there anything at this point that gives you hope for a resolution?
Right now I'm just feeling very sad and not that hopeful. That's unfortunate to say. Eventually it will end in some way. The beginning, the coup, they were saying we're going to take power for 1 year and then hold another election. Now they've already said now 2 years. It's going to be some years down the road before anything. And so many people are suffering and, you know, losing their livelihood and starving. And
is it safe for your Burmese colleagues or your now former Burmese colleagues to have contact with you?
Yeah, I think so. I was never detained for any reason. I think they have to be really careful what they have on their phones. Like, you know, in Burma they use Facebook for everything. People are very vocal on that, but now they're starting to stop people on the streets and check their phones, and so people are figuring out ways to hide what apps they have on there and what the information about the coup they have. But then some don't care. They're like, let them arrest me, I'll die for this. They're in a war, but only one side has weapons. It's not even a war, it's just a slaughter. It's like a genocide.
Because citizens are not allowed to have guns at all.
Right. Some of these ethnic armies in the north are a bit armed, but they're very rudimentary things. And people are making Molotov cocktails and throwing those. And they're very peaceful. It's very strange because it's Burmese people who are killing them, but the general population, these people are very peaceful. They wouldn't think of having a gun. I thought getting away, I'd be relieved, but I'm not. I'm more wrought up and like angrier that no one here even, oh, a coup? No, I haven't heard anything about it. Like, are you kidding me?
Colorado's a million miles away.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I understand there's a lot going on in our country too. Like, we're in pretty big crisis here as well. But this, as the UN envoy said, there's no place in the 21st century for a coup. This is ridiculous. Come on.
Last week, the 10-member Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, met in Jakarta in an emergency session to discuss the coup. What resulted from the summit was a 5-point consensus, including calls to end the killing of protesters immediately, begin dialogue between opposing groups, create an ASEAN chair to facilitate dialogue, give more humanitarian assistance, and allow the ASEAN chair to visit Myanmar.
That's it for today on Jackson Unpacked. Original music for the show is by the local band Strawbucket. Tune in for Jackson Unpacked every week, Wednesday mornings at 7:30 a.m. and Fridays and Sundays at 12:30 p.m. And remember to subscribe to Jackson Unpacked, the podcast, on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. I'm Kyle Mackey, and this is KHOL Jackson.